This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 320 was recorded on April 21st, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by FarmTogether.com, where you can hedge against inflation and protect your portfolio by investing in U.S. farmland, now available to all accredited investors. And by Composer, making institutional-grade quantitative algorithmic trading and backtesting available to the masses. Simplify Asset Management's Mike Green returns as this week's feature interview guest. Mike is coming out of the proverbial closet as the first Macro Voices guest to tell me privately off the air more than a year ago that World War III had begun a year before that, a statement Dr. Pippa Malmgren recently echoed in her Macro Voices interview. Mike will explain why he made those statements, what he sees on the horizon, and what it means for investors and markets. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Sector Rotation.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, the S&P 500 for the last 2 weeks has been more or less consolidating after a really explosive rally through the latter part of March. Do you think that there's enough gas in the tank for more upside from here, or what's your take on the markets?
Well, I don't really have any strong conviction about direction of equity markets because I freely admit I don't understand what's holding it up. We've got the tapering coming. We've got a hiking cycle that most people agree is a good reason to be bearish. And it leaves me wondering, okay, what does it take to actually get a cyclical bear market? I feel like this market has held itself up, defying all odds. And so I don't know what's driving it, but it doesn't make sense to me that we're not seeing lower numbers.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index. We're still holding above the 100 level. I mean, a little bit of a pullback in the last couple of days, but still above 100. Do you think there's more upside from here?
Oh, I definitely do. I think 104 is the next major resistance line to be watching. And, you know, the outcome of World War III and the outcome of this fourth turning, which should run at least through 2030, could very well be the loss of dollar hegemony and the replacement of the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency. But that's not happening right now, and there is no viable alternative to the U.S. dollar right now as global reserve currency. As long as those things are true, this war cycle, to me, just has to say stronger dollar.
All right, well, let's talk about crude oil. It's just amazing the volatility, but it's been directionless. Like we come to the top end of a range, come right back down to the bottom end of a range, and it seems like there's a lack of conviction to go to the next level on crude. What do you think is in store next?
Well, I think we're seeing churn between major news events. What's been driving all of this, I say, is World War III. And I think the really big question is those people, and I think it's probably the majority of the oil market, that sees this conflict as the Ukraine-Russia war. They understandably think that this is pretty much coming to an end and almost over, perhaps. I don't see it that way. I think that it may be that the Ukraine-Russia battle in World War III, which is a much, much bigger, longer-lasting thing, may be coming to an end, but there'll be another battle after that. So it really is a matter of context. I think we're ultimately headed much higher in terms of oil prices, but right now, as long as you've got talk about maybe solving problems by having OPEC increase production and so forth, and there are a lot of people who I think incorrectly perceive that OPEC has the spare capacity that they could make up for Russian production, even if there was a complete denial of access to Russian oil. I don't think those things are right, but it's going to take time to see what happens. Meanwhile, we're also getting a lot of very noisy inventory signals. Remember, last week we had that massive 9 million barrel build on inventory. This week it was a 12.7 million barrel drawdown on inventory. Likewise, we're also seeing U.S. production ticking up to 11.9 million barrels. That's a trend that a lot of people didn't anticipate of increasing U.S. production. So many people thought it was impossible to get back to the old numbers, around 13 million per day. And we're only a little over a million barrels away from that at this point. So there's lots of moving pieces here, and there's lots of reasons I think it makes sense to see all this volatility. I think it ultimately resolves to the upside, but it's very possible that if we saw a pause in the war cycle for 6 months, that could take us, you know, $10 or $15 lower before the next chapter of World War III reveals itself and takes us much higher.
All right, Eric, let's touch on gold. I mean, we were toying with 2,000, and suddenly it's just giving it back and doesn't want to get out of the starting blocks here. What do you think's in store for gold?
I don't know why anybody's impressed with gold here. I think everything else that you could think of as a hedge for inflation or geopolitical risk or anything else that you're trying to hedge, all the other hedges performed better than precious metals. I think, unfortunately, I mean, could it be that the reason for this is that too many people have decided that crypto replaces gold and they would rather put their store of value hedge into a crypto asset instead of gold? That might be the driver. I'm not sure. But one way or another, I don't see anything impressive about the way this gold chart has reacted. And it's had reason to really react. Now, if you think that World War III is baloney and not really happening, and that this is just a Ukraine-Russia war, which is coming to an end, that sounds to me like a reason to get really bearish on gold here. Now, I don't think that's what's happening. I think World War III is going strong, and I do think that the fundamentals that should be driving gold much, much higher, we ought to at least drive it moderately higher, even if we continue to see this underperformance that we're seeing. But strategically, long-term, I definitely regret having such a large allocation to precious metals and having had such a, you know, having no allocation to copper and other base metals that have performed far better in this inflation cycle.
All right. Well, let's touch on that 10-year treasury yield. I mean, 3% is almost there. I mean, we printed on an intraday basis 2.98. And is 3% going to be cleared here? Or do you think that this has gone a little too far too quickly?
Well, it has gone too far too quickly, but that doesn't mean it's not coming. And I think the tell here, I'll be the first to admit, you know, we looked at just breaking above 2%. I was very clear in saying, look, folks, I don't have any conviction. I'm listening to our expert guests, and we got them on both sides. We'll try to get you different perspectives. The folks that were saying, look, it's not going much farther than this, maybe 2.25. Okay, look, that was a view that certainly it's hard call to make. Can't have everybody be right about everything. But I think it's time to say it's not going much past 2%, guys. Got this one wrong. I don't see any reason that we shouldn't expect yields to continue to back up. But again, we've had some really smart people say they don't think it can go that far, and they don't think that we're really and truly on the cusp of a runaway secular inflation type of event. They really do think it's going to be transitory and that it will peak in the first or second quarter. Or maybe now they're saying second quarter. It was going to be first quarter. I'm not sure that it peaked then. We'll see what happens.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Mike Green, the Chief Macro Strategist and Portfolio Manager at Simplify Asset Management. Now, Eric, why did we get Mike back on the show this week?
Patrick, when we broadcast Pippa Malmgren's recent interview, I told our listeners that one of our guests had told me in secret that he thought World War III had actually begun about 2 years ago and didn't want to come out of the closet on that. Well, when he heard that interview, Mike called us up and said, okay, I'm ready to come out of the closet and talk publicly. We booked him right away. We wanted to get that interview on the air so that our listeners can better understand not only why did Mike think that more than a year ago, but why was he so hesitant to tell us? I asked him that question as well.
Well, Eric's interview with Mike Green is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
With inflation reaching a 40-year high, investors are looking toward real assets to help safeguard their portfolio. One asset is rising in popularity. Farmland has consistently provided returns more than double the inflation rate since before 1992. How? Because farmland's value is underpinned by its critical role in the global economy. The country's growing population needs to eat. Farmland is well positioned to maintain its value over time, no matter the economic condition. As the supply of arable land in the United States shrinks each year, high-quality farmland should only become that much more valuable in the long run. Interested in adding farmland to your portfolio? head to farmtogether.com. Farm Together is tapping into the nearly $3 trillion U.S. farmland market to bring unparalleled access to institutional quality farmland through a variety of products, including crowdfunded farmland offerings, 1031 exchange, sole ownership bespoke offerings, and most recently, the Sustainable Farmland Fund. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Mike Green, Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager for Simplify Asset Management. Mike, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been way too long.
Oh, thanks, Eric. It has been too long.
I told our listeners when I interviewed Dr. Pippa Malmgren that long before I interviewed Pippa, a couple of different very senior people who I respect a lot had told me, quote, World War III has already begun. And Mike, I want to now bring you out of the closet as the first guy who said that to me. And what you actually told me, I think a year ago now, was you said World War III began a full year ago. So that would be 2 years ago now at this point. Something that I realized, I didn't really take that seriously at first. And the reason is, for me personally, those three words, World War III, equate directly to certain nuclear Armageddon that ends humanity forever. And I thought that was too extreme of a conclusion to come to, and I was a little bit surprised by it. After reading Dr. Pippa Malmgren's piece on what she meant by World War III has already begun, she's not talking about nuclear Armageddon. She's talking about a whole new kind of warfare that is fought primarily on digital battlefields, and it really is the nuclear superpowers at war with one another, but she doesn't think that it's necessarily headed toward that nuclear Armageddon scenario. So let's start by clarifying, what precisely did you mean when you said to me a year ago that World War III had begun a year earlier than that?
Well, what I meant by that was that we had entered into a period of great power competition and that we were going to see the world begin to fracture. And unfortunately, that seems certainly more true today than it was back then. I would argue in many ways, the Trump tariffs on China were kind of the slap in the face that opened up this whole idea of we're actually going to begin to compete quite overtly. I think the odd thing about what happened under the Trump administration was that Trump himself was very uncomfortable pushing forward a narrative that might harm the stock market, right, or might harm his popularity. So this is this weird dynamic where within the administration, I was hearing a very clear change in tone and recognition that we had entered into overt competition, particularly with the Chinese, to a lesser extent with the Russians. And I would suggest that it doesn't have to mean global thermonuclear war, right? This can be a limited engagement, but it absolutely is involving a whole globe competition that is similar to, you know, the Napoleonic Wars of the 19th century, the 17th century, to a lesser extent, the competition between France and the United and Great Britain that manifested itself in the French Indian Wars, and to turn that into the first global dynamic, etc. This time around, it began in the trade trenches, but long before that, it was already happening, as you note, in digital cyberspace, where China was basically doing everything that they could to steal every critical technology and propel themselves forward in a very fast moving way. The irony is that this is actually very similar to the way that World War II developed, right? It doesn't start as a giant global conflict. It begins as a series of effectively border skirmishes, right? And I find it a great irony that we're seeing the exact same type of dynamics that occurred at the start of that kind of 1937 to 1939 transition, where it became clear that we were re-entering World War II, the rearmament had already been started. The US government and the UK government were actively working to get their multinational corporations to withdraw involvement from places like Germany and Russia. You saw the US suspend diplomatic relations with Russia at the beginning part of 1937 as Stalin had consolidated control and it became clear the extent of their spying operations against the United States. So this just feels the exact same way. right? Now, does it go kinetic nuclear? Man, that's a, you know, that's the bad outcome, right? But it does very much feel that the world is fracturing, and fracturing for many of the same reasons. The global superpower has had to pull back, right? It is not playing the role of global policeman. And as we see in US cities all over the place, when you reduce police enforcement, crime spikes. And some form of loss in law, of law and order is what's happening around the globe right now.
Mike, when you told me this information about a year ago, it was in connection with an interview we were doing at the time, but you opted not to go public with that view at that time. Was that just because you were afraid it was so radical that it was going to cause people to dismiss you as a nutcase? Or why is it that you were hesitant to go on record, even though you were so emphatic in telling me on the phone that you thought World War III had already begun?
Well, I think the question always becomes, why does it matter? Right. So to the extent that you make an observation that, hey, I think our neighbors are going to sell their house, you know, you don't take out a giant advertisement to say this. You say it to your friends. There wasn't particular relevance associated with this other than for me, it was a part of the exploration. Those who listened to my early Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein podcast, remember I said, you know, as it related to the coronavirus, that there's something else going on, right? The level of incompetence, the level of control seizure, et cetera, that was underway was clearly indicative that there was something else. And I would just broadly argue that this is that something else, right? We're seeing all the behaviors that had been given a trial run in the early stages of the coronavirus have now been amped up, right? So look at what's happening with China. Look what's happening to social control features in Russia, the propaganda dynamics that, you know, we've worked awfully hard to get very good at. American citizens are on the receiving end of that for the first time in a war that we're not propagating, right? So, you know, this is not us getting cool videos from the bombing of Iraq and, you know, General Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf showing us the luckiest man in Iraq as he barely escapes a bridge being blown up behind him as he drives over it, right? That was entertainment in a lot of ways, even though people were dying. This is far more complex. We're very much in this intense debate where two countries, Russia and Ukraine, neither of which are particularly well thought of in normal times, you know, one has been transformed into, you know, the bastion of light and freedom in the world. And the other one has been turned into a caricature of evil incarnate. It's a very different experience today versus trying to throw that out there a year ago when, you know, candidly, you ran a very real risk of being interpreted as saying one of two things. Either you thought that China had intentionally released the virus and therefore that was the first step in the process and you were some form of tinfoil hat wearing entity, or that you were, you know, trying to engage in some form of, you know, shock value in an environment in which there was just far too much shock already going around. And the last thing I would just point out is that, you know, people have to recognize that while we're always trying to dig down and identify the truth of what's going on, if I go back a year ago, I'm not sure that it's particularly helpful to begin focusing on this idea of the World War III dynamic in an environment in which markets are broadly bullish, right? You're not trying to scare people out of the markets. And exactly as you pointed out, if I start bringing up the concept of thermonuclear war, that seems particularly unhelpful from an investment framework.
Now, the biggest mistake that people tend to make, both in war and in investing, is to try to fight the last battle at the next battle. So I'm assuming if we think about how to be prepared as investors for this World War III environment, it's not about expecting everybody to hoard rubber to make aircraft tires with, which was the really big thing during World War II. What is it about? Is it going to be about energy scarcity or what?
Well, I think you're seeing two very important dynamics. And, you know, you're obviously extraordinarily familiar with the work of Peter Zeihan, et cetera. There is a very clear competition for control. And you've heard me use this language before, for control of what I refer to or what is broadly referred to as the world island, right? So the continent of Eurasia sits at the center of this conflict in the same way that it sat at the center of the last conflict in terms of World War II. And most wars tend to be fought around this dynamic, right? There's effectively a Nash equilibrium where the European peninsula, Russia, the Middle East, India, and China are always in competition for control of this world island. Russia made a move to try to, you know, reinforce, in its words, its defenses, try to build back up the barriers that Peter Zeihan identifies. And kind of true to form, if we're actually in this World War II, you know, World War III type framework, I would argue one of the most important things that happened is the speed of the Western response, right? This betrays that we were prepared for this. It doesn't feel like it, but policy choices were made in a matter of days and weeks that normally, you know, would take forever. I did not anticipate the speed of the response. And to me, if anything, that just reinforces how seriously Western governments are taking this new narrative.
Let's talk about what some of the themes would be for how a World War III would be fought in contrast to how World War II was fought. One of the things that it seems like Pippa Malmgren emphasized was that it would be on digital battlefields, that we'd be looking at more examples of, you know, one sovereign hacking another sovereign's systems and, you know, breaking their nuclear capability by hacking the controllers that run their centrifuges, as opposed to dropping bombs on those same facilities. I have held the view myself that I think Western governments have been extremely slow to recognize how incredibly important digital currency is really going to be. And I think that Russia and China are both working very aggressively on trying to one-up the West by beating them to some kind of sovereign digital currency system that could potentially compete with the U.S. dollar or could be designed for the purpose of competing with the U.S. dollar for the title of global reserve currency. Those are a couple of thoughts off the top of my head. Am I on the right track? And if I'm not, what things should I be thinking about in terms of what's coming?
Well, you used a really important phrase where you said, you know, we always fight the last war, right? So the Maginot Line is designed to prevent the incursion across, you know, the lines of attack that existed in World War One. This time around, like, you know, the Navy, for example, is actually trying to tell us in the United States that they don't want battleships and they don't want aircraft carriers. And politicians are saying, how could you possibly talk about reducing the size of the force, right? The military is telling us that that type of heavy equipment, and we're seeing this very much in Russia, you know, it is extraordinarily vulnerable to the new weapons technologies, the offensive weapons technologies like hypersonic missiles, like Poseidon missiles, et cetera. You know, it's remarkable when you think about the idea that the U.S. would dramatically expand its physical Navy as compared to unmanned drones, hypersonics, subs, et cetera, after watching what just transpired with, you know, the flagship of the Russian fleet in the Black Sea, right? That's a big deal when you see a ship like that go down. You know, it's not dissimilar to the dynamics of the German U-boats in World War One. There is a change of technology that means that the historical tools are remarkably vulnerable. Now, this is where I think I may differ from Pippa, is what that means is that you're going to see low kinetic, you know, theoretically plausible deniability around attacks, right? So I can engage in ransomware attacks or attacks on industrial facilities or communication networks, et cetera. And I can always say, well, where's your evidence, right? The vast majority of people aren't going to see it the same way and they aren't going to treat it the same way. But eventually you start developing the new technologies that have to ultimately reinforce this. So if it continues, I think like almost every conflict, we will eventually see physical force. We're seeing an extreme version of that in Ukraine right now. If we get pulled in, is, you know, in terms of a direct conflict is uncertain at this point, but it certainly feels increasingly likely. The Biden administration appears very willing to ultimately commit much more aggressively to the defense of Ukraine than we've done so far.
Mike, let's go deeper on that subject, because something that I've noticed and I have been horrified by is both President Biden and particularly, I forget the specific name of a senator who on television said, we should not rule out the use of first use nuclear strikes against Russia because of this Ukraine situation. Now, President Barack Obama, I think very astutely, said that Ukraine is absolutely essential to Russia's interests, but is of almost no consequence to the United States' interest. Therefore, it would be foolish of the United States to ever make Ukraine a big priority or to get into a big battle over Ukraine. Obviously, President Biden has a different philosophy. The guy who went on television and said we ought to be considering first-use nuclear strikes, back in the Cold War, a senior government official of the United States just saying those words publicly would have been justification for an all-out nuclear strike on Russia's part, because those kinds of words are fighting words in this nuclear world that we live in. Now, what should we make of this? I really feel like the understanding that I grew up with, I'm 56 and I'm definitely at the very end of the Cold War era. People younger than me don't remember any of this stuff. But what we learned is it doesn't matter whether Putin's a good guy or a bad guy, and it doesn't matter how bad of a horrible thing he did. The point is, he's got a button that can terminate humanity on Earth if he wants to. According to Dr. Pippa Malmgren, he has probably already installed a dead man switch to make sure that if he is assassinated in a coup, that World War III nuclear escalation will probably begin automatically. With those kinds of threats, what Pippa Malmgren said and what I agree emphatically with is we cannot afford escalation. It doesn't matter how wrong they are, how horrible the atrocities are. It doesn't matter, because if we try to say we're not going to let you do this and it escalates to nuclear conflict, everybody dies. That's mutual assured destruction. My generation was brought up understanding that it doesn't matter if we don't agree. We have to accept that they've got the ability to end humanity. We can't mess with these people. It seems to me like all of a sudden our political elite are ready to mess with Russia, and it scares the hell out of me.
Well, so like many things, I think there was an element of confusion that kicks in here, right? So first of all, the senator I believe you're talking about is, I think it's Wicker, is the senator who brought that up. We have Roger Wicker, and that was back in December of 21. It's hard to believe that we brought it up first, right? And then following the invasion of Ukraine, Putin put his nuclear forces on effectively, you know, status so that if he presses the button, which obviously isn't quite a button, there is no questioning about it, right? It's not a vote. It's this is what we're going to do. And I agree with you. I think that, you know, we are very much poking the bear, and I'm not referring to Russia per se as the bear and his characterization, but more in terms of saying we can do whatever we want. You know, we can openly ship arms into Ukraine. We can openly have U.S. advisors, you know, the classic air quote advisors that are facilitating the Ukrainian response. This is very dangerous territory, very, very dangerous territory. And I think Pippa describes it quite well, that Putin is basically waiting for us to step over the line so that he can punch as hard as he possibly can, because he's not going to get another shot, right? This is his decision that he's going to go. You know, it is a frightening environment. We are dealing with a country that most people don't realize how existential the risk is for Russia as it faces demographic deterioration, as it faces growing powers on its borders, the advance of NATO, as well as the growth of China, which ultimately represents significant risk to Russia on its eastern front. You know, this is a country that feels cornered. And I'm not suggesting that that means that we have to tolerate bad behavior or that we should encourage bad behavior. But the simple reality is that realpolitik has always dominated the world, right? It's not a question of good versus evil. It's a question of what lives do we want to place at risk? And you're 100% correct that it feels like we are being bizarrely cavalier about the risks that we are taking.
Somebody famous, I forget who, said of Russia, "I know lots and lots of tactics to coax that bear out of his cave. The problem is, once he's out, I don't know any tactic to get him back in." And I fear that we're already at that point. And I wonder if you agree with that. But if so, you know, this is a macroeconomics and investing show. We need to think about what this means in terms of economic trends that our professional audience can invest in as we hopefully don't approach any kind of nuclear war. So it's not about rubber for tires this time. What's it about?
Well, there is an element of it's about rubber for tires, right? Because Russia produces, and not Russia in terms of rubber, but Russia produces an awful lot of oil that goes into the production of tires, as do others, right? And so we are broadly talking about the same sort of shortages that emerge, and that does become a critical component, right? That is part of the huge reason why Japan advanced on places like Malaysia, et cetera, because they wanted access to what at the time were the only real sources of rubber, which was natural rubber plants. You know, the development of synthetic rubber in the course of the war was a critical innovation that really helped the United States. And I would argue we're going to see the exact same sorts of things, right? So we're currently seeing the dynamics of a world that is being fractured, where China is not shipping us stuff. That's contributing to a need to invest in the same way that you invest in a war effort, right? So we're being forced to put ourselves somewhat on war footing. Do we start to bring semiconductor production home? Do we start to bring chemical production home? Do we bring rare earths production home? And all of those require higher prices in order to create the operating umbrella, the profitability umbrella that allows the development of those resources in regions that you would otherwise choose not to develop them. Right. So, you know, rare earths are a perfect example. The term rare earths implies that there's something unusual or rare about these. But the key is when you say rare earths, what you're actually talking about is slightly less common dirt, right? It's none of these things are quote unquote truly rare, like a precious metal. They're just relatively uncommon. And therefore, you have to dig up a whole bunch of dirt and produce a whole bunch of byproduct waste in order to get the products that you want. China has been uniquely willing to engage in that type of pollution. We're going to have to see that change, right? We are also seeing on the economic front, and this is, I think, the much more relevant component, we're seeing a return to, you know, I know Zoltan Pozsars talks about, you know, the Bretton Woods 3 dynamic ending and the move towards a Bancor type commodity currency. Man, I see the exact opposite. I see this actually as returning effectively to the reality of Bretton Woods 1, which was not a US dollar standard for the world, but a US dollar standard for a subset of the world, for that fraction of the world that chose to engage with capitalism in the West or play puppet states in aligning with the West. They were on a dollar standard. The rest of the world was on a ruble standard. Do I think that we go back to a ruble standard? Highly unlikely. Do I think that Russia and China are working as rapidly and as hard as they possibly can to introduce alternatives to the SWIFT type system that allows continued trade with those entities without having to go through the messaging based permissioning system of the US dominated SWIFT system? 100%. And do cryptocurrencies and digital currencies play a critical role in that? I don't think there's any question about it.
Let's go back to the energy aspects of this. You know, just in the course of our recording this conversation on Wednesday afternoon, a tweet went by from Dr. Anas Alhaji, where he says here, we do have the ability to source the grades of oil that we need without Russia. We could eliminate Russia. But the problem is we don't have the capacity in terms of quantity to replace the amount of oil that Russia produces. Now, I find this really striking because, first of all, Dr. Anas Alhaji is Mr. Crude Quality Matters. He's constantly talking about how quality matters more than quantity. And specifically, he's really good buddies personally with the senior policymakers in Saudi Arabia. What Anas, I think, is telling us here is a really important signal. If a guy who's that close with the Saudis is kind of hinting that the Saudis don't really have the spare capacity to ramp up to replace Russia's production, I say you want to believe him and believe him now. So I think we got a real problem that most of the market doesn't understand, which is they're saying, okay, the EU is about to impose this sanction against Russia. So we've got to calculate the economic impact of that on the price of oil. My argument is forget about that. That's chicken shit. Start thinking about what happens when Russia makes it a tactic of war to intentionally take action to try to deny access to crude oil to the West. and does everything militarily that they can in order to foment that outcome. What would that world look like, and how big of a deal is it?
Well, so first of all, I don't disagree with Anais, and I would emphasize that his focus on the quality and different crude grades is one that feels like it's being missed broadly by politicians who are doing things like releasing from the SPR, et cetera, right? You know, refining operations are extraordinarily complex chemical factories, and the manner in which they are designed to be run is, you know, just like, imagine Breaking Bad, right? And Walter White producing blue methamphetamine. It's extraordinarily dependent on the inputs and the process that you use for managing it. And I think that's broadly one of the things that people are missing, right? So whether we can talk about Venezuelan crude replacing various forms of the high sulfur content that is needed, you know, those are all things that I think can happen, but it takes time and it takes effort. Can you reconfigure those complex chemical factories so that they run more efficiently than they currently do on things like West Texas Intermediate or the sweet crudes? Of course, but it takes time. And time is one of the things that you don't have a lot of when the world is fighting through the sort of inflationary dynamics or the high prices that have emerged in the aftermath of restarting the world from coronavirus. That's a world that looks like higher oil prices, right? And higher oil prices do two things. One, they eventually spur a supply response. And two, they spur innovations in terms of how to use oil more efficiently. So if oil is $10 a barrel or negative $37 a barrel, you behave very differently in your conservation efforts than you do if oil is at $185 a barrel, as I've seen floated around in the aftermath of Europe talking about banning Russian crude. You know, we can't know the answer because ultimately those prices are set at an intersection of supply and demand. We can talk a lot about the supply side. We can develop some comfort that the quantity of barrels are there. We have less certainty around the demand side of the equation, particularly with uncertainty around what's really happening with Chinese demand. And then I would toss out one last component, though, which is when you get to the edge of production levels, technically, yes, we can replace them, but then you become extremely fragile in terms of your response to unfortunate events. For example, what's happening in Libya right now, where there's been a flare-up in the civil crisis that is effectively shutting down production at the worst possible time for the world, right? That happens when resources go up in value. There's continually a competition for control of these resources. And exactly like, you know, rare earths, most resources come from places in the world where people don't really want to live, right? It's, you know, somewhat a tautology that there's not high demand for condos, you know, hanging out on the edge of copper mines or oil fields. And so you're looking at a situation in which the world is just becoming more fragile at the same time that we rely more on that next incremental barrel that is being produced. And that just produces high inelasticity, which means prices become exceptionally volatile. And that volatility, you know, is very similar to another increase in price. I don't have a direct relationship that I could point you to, but I would be willing to strongly hypothesize that oil stable at $100 is actually far less damaging than oil that vacillates wildly between $50 and $150. In other words, the incentive to figure out how to replace that oil rises as the volatility rises. Replace meaning substitute and eliminate it from the process.
Let's talk about why the rest of the world doesn't seem to see things the way you and I do, Mike, because I think you and I agree this is a really big issue. But when I hear things like not just the Biden administration, but a lot of people that I really respect in the oil industry calling for even greater SPR releases to help address the cost of gasoline at the pump and so forth. These are professionals who understand this stuff, who are advocating for what to me is akin to, okay, look, I got the binoculars out, I can see there is a confirmed tidal wave on the horizon headed for our beach. Let's cancel our flood insurance and use the premium to, you know, buy Cracker Jacks with, so we got something to watch popcorn when the wave comes in. Why in the world, when you have this geopolitical risk, would you be emptying your SPR instead of topping it off at any price? And why is it that most of the oil industry doesn't see that risk and actually agrees with the Biden administration that it's a good time to be selling off the SPR, as we're doing this week with a bunch of oil coming out of the SPR, for the sake of bringing prices down? What about the national security risk of we were supposed to keep that oil for a rainy day when we couldn't get any more?
Well, so there's a part of it, and you know oil probably better than I do by a reasonable margin, but there is an element of the SPR was particularly important in an environment in which the U.S. was a major importer of oil. It becomes less important when we're a net exporter, in part because the grades of oil that we have in the SPR are not particularly well suited for a lot of the refining operations that we have in the United States, which is, you know, part of the great irony, right? We pump our own oil in and then we keep a mix that is not particularly useful in terms of our own demand. So I'm a little bit less concerned about the SPR releases than I think most are. But I do think that you're correct that, you know, this is part and parcel of a broadly reactionary firefighting type dynamic within this administration. And hopefully it was clear. I don't think the Republican administration under Trump was any better, right? We've become extraordinarily short-term focused of, you know, oh gosh, there's a problem. Let's, you know, douse it with as much water and fire extinguishers as possible without necessarily paying attention to, you know, well, is there actually an arsonist and should we focus on capturing the arsonist rather than continually putting out these tiny fires? We're not doing a good job of dealing with the arson, you know, the arsonist risk. We're busy putting out his fires.
Let's talk beyond energy at other commodities and where the World War III related demand and trends are going to come from. What is this going to mean in terms of broader commodities? Certainly in the case of grains and food, a lot of people are speculating that food shortages are going to be part of a World War III scenario. Is that true? And what else should we be thinking about?
Well, again, when you talk about food shortages, the people who suffer from food shortages are those who are on the edge anyway, right? So the United States is not on the edge, right? You may have to deal with the dynamics of you can't get your favorite flavor of Twinkie, and we may be faced with the unfortunate circumstance in which Oreos reduces the 27 varieties they now seem to have on the shelf to 3 varieties. We go back to, you know, double stuff and regular, but we're not facing true deprivation in the United States. There will unquestionably be an increase in, and there has been an increase in food stressed households, children, et cetera, but we'll have the mechanisms available to allocate those resources and make sure that people in the United States get fed. The real risk in things like foodstuffs emerges in countries that have historically been able to rely on a stable system to import a sizable fraction of their food while exporting, using their land to export cash crops. So Egypt, for example, exporting cotton while importing wheat and corn is a significant example of that, right? They will be forced to reduce their cash crop production in order to inefficiently produce food to improve their security. That means the world faces an aggregate shortfall of SOFs that is then only exacerbated by the dynamics of fertilizer shortages, et cetera. And again, fertilizer shortages are one of these weird things where if it were to happen slowly, you know, soil can recover and you can reduce dependence on fertilizer. But you can't just cut it off, right? Because the beneficial bacteria, et cetera, have been wiped out by the way that we have largely farmed this stuff. We're looking at a very real shortage here. And it's going to hit the developing world far, far worse than it's going to hit us. Again, I think we'll have reduced choice and higher expenses. But that's a totally different environment than you can't get food on the table, which is going to happen around the world.
Let's talk about what this means for the stock market, because it seems to me, you know, you're talking World War III. Those are pretty big, strong words. Dr. Pippa Malmgren says World War III already began. Stock market's down, what, 4% or so in the news? Seems to me like we're not exactly in a panic here.
I got to be honest with you. That feels nuclear to me. 4%. My God, how are people handling these losses? Now, look, there's a lot of ways I can paint a picture for you that this turns into a positive outcome, right? So traditionally, you're supposed to buy when the bullets fly. Nowhere was that more true than March 2020, right? And, you know, if you think back in that context, it becomes somewhat ironic. But we are absolutely looking at a situation where the U.S. could reshore a significant fraction of productive capacity, leading to significant increases in wages. And we're broadly seeing that at the same time that we're seeing things like California just announced a significant expansion of retirement programs, such that any employer that has more than five employees is now in a situation where they have to offer a 401k, right? So we're not seeing any sign of deterioration of flows into markets, particularly through the passive vehicles. We are starting to see some signs that the active flows are beginning to turn down again. But this is one of the things you and I were talking about. I mean, the data on sentiment is unbelievably bad. Not only do I work with Simplify, but I also have an investment in a firm called Tier 1 Alpha that is focused around a lot of the data and options and other stuff. And we're going through some of the charts that we're in the process of developing. And I mean, everything ranging from the fraction of the market that is down, you know, X percent, let's say 20, 30, 40, 50 percent, it's full on bear market levels with the top line indices barely having retreated.
Let's talk more about that, because we've got, as you say, top line indices barely showing anything. But it's not like you'd have trouble finding a stock that's down more than 10%. There's lots of those. So it's almost like there's been a breadth crash that nobody's really talking about.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, if I look at, you know, I'll just highlight, like, if I look at a chart that does a better job of representing that type of breadth, you know, the Russell 2000 broadly is now down, you know, over the past year, has basically gone absolutely nowhere after an attempted breakout in the fourth quarter of 2021. But is, you know, that's an incredibly vulnerable looking chart, right? It looks an awful lot like what we had heading into the fourth quarter of 2015, for example. To a lesser extent, maybe the fourth quarter of 2018, where, you know, it had sold off below the 200 day and then was unable to retake it. Those look a heck of a lot worse as markets than I think that the headline would suggest. And so, you know, my bias continues to be that there's going to be some form of move lower and pain associated with it. But if I look at the headlines again, you know, I keep getting drawn back to the dynamic of what's going to cause the flows to change. And the only thing that really gets them to change in my analysis is if we see a meaningful change in employment. And we see a dramatic, you know, a meaningful reduction where people start to get fired. It feels like that's coming. We've seen the yield curve invert. You know, there's all sorts of dynamics around that, but it hasn't happened yet. And a lot of people are very focused on that recession, that dynamic that, oh, the yield curve inverted. There's also some irony around that, right? Somebody posted the other day that, you know, the number of people who posted on the yield curve inverting was, you know, off the charts. And the number of people who posted when it began to steepen again was very low. Well, part of the reason for that is that, you know, we only care that it indicated that a recession is coming, right? It will steepen out of it. We'll see the yield curve normalize. Everyone's going to forget aspects of this. And then we'll see if we actually get that recession. And if that recession occurs, then I expect the flows to deteriorate. And that's what I'm very focused on right now, is do we see the economy really meaningfully turn lower? Do we see employment weaken? And there's a lot of reasons, as we were talking about it, when you talk about reshoring and bringing stuff back on, why that could behave differently this time.
It seems to me that sentiment has to be a really big piece of this, because frankly, as I look at this whole situation, I don't feel like most people are getting it. I don't think that the general society around me understands that we are sparring with some awfully dangerous words with nuclear superpowers. Is there a moment where kind of the whole world wakes up and says, holy cow, this World War III thing actually has some reality to it? It's time to panic? Is it a question of they haven't panicked yet and that's coming? Or why is it that you and I both see the world in a really scary place, but most people don't seem to be too concerned?
I mean, this is the same answer you hear me give to a bunch of stuff, right? I mean, whose target date fund that captures 85% of the retirement flows that are now coming in? I don't know a single target date fund that has like a checkbox for, you know, pause investments upon threat of World War III. I think that's part of the reason why we see the disconnect between flows and sentiment. Individual investors who answer questions like the AAII, they are inevitably focused on the stocks that they've selected in their portfolio. But in the greater scheme of things, they're increasingly irrelevant versus the overall flow that goes into vehicles like Vanguard and BlackRock. You know, so I agree with you. I think the sentiment is the most interesting thing that's out there, the disconnect between sentiment and price levels. But the risk is that sentiment reflects the professional investor class. It reflects the those who can make somewhat discretionary choices, those who can respond to the higher realized levels of volatility that we've been experiencing for the past year or so. And all of those contribute to effectively selling out of the active and discretionary community, while the passive community effectively hodls and accumulates. And if sentiment turns, right? So let's just imagine for a second that sentiment turns, Russia decides to embrace the West, China recognizes the error of its ways. We come together in a giant kumbaya, and we print $1 trillion just to celebrate the unification. Who are you going to buy those shares from when you decide to get bullish again? I mean, Vanguard's not going to sell them to you. BlackRock's not going to sell them to you. The T. Rowe Target Date Fund's not going to sell it to you. So the only solution is you find other now bullish investors to sell it to you. And guess what? That's what happened in March 2020 through, give or take, you know, February of 2021. So, you know, it scares the hell out of me to sit there and say on the eve of, you know, or as we're involved in World War III, that like this still feels that there is the potential for an extraordinary bullish move here. But I get very concerned when I hear all the discretionary people telling me the same thing and how depressed they are and you know, that this is the clearest negative setup in history. Unless somebody tells Vanguard and they change their policies, I struggle to see how it becomes all that meaningful.
Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, please give our listeners a quick rundown of what you guys do at Simplify Asset Management.
So Simplify is an ETF firm. We launched in September 2020, and our unique approach is to take traditional exposures. So for example, US equities, large cap, and then apply derivative overlays, which is really kind of my area of expertise and experience, that allow us to modify that payout, either improving downside performance, improving upside performance, generating additional yield, et cetera. And we do that across U.S. equities. We've recently introduced credit products that are designed to hedge against credit events. We have an interest rate hedge product that is doing extraordinarily well in an environment in which interest rates have been rising. We didn't talk much about the Fed, for example. And we also have introduced, you know, the first managed future strategies in ETF form that are capable of being rebalanced at the frequency that you usually want to think about managed futures. And so, you know, we try to be a very technologically progressive and fast forward ETF firm in terms of incorporating unique strategies that are capable of delivering unique payout features to the retail and registered investment advisor markets.
Well, I look forward to getting you back on the show for an update on World War III and other subjects. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. For decades, quantitative hedge funds like Renaissance, Citadel, and Two Sigma have benefited from the development of systematic or rules-based trading. Renaissance's Medallion Fund returned 66% per year from 1998 through 2018. Medallion is run by an army of data scientists, mathematicians, and neural engineers that build code to take advantage of exogenous market movements. There's a reason why over $1 trillion is managed in quantitative hedge funds. However, unless you have a PhD or a Python expert, building trading algorithms has been next to impossible. Until now. Composer is a VC-backed startup that lets anyone build quantitative strategies for free. No code or Excel required. With Composer, you can easily build strategies with their drag-and-drop, no-code visual editor. Or invest in their pre-vetted strategies, like paired switching S&P 500 and bonds, or buy the dips NASDAQ. To learn more, go to composer.trade today. That's composer.trade today.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Mike Green back onto the show. You know, he really makes the hamster wheel turn in terms of how the world is reshaping on a geopolitical front. And just being able to sort out that puzzle pieces to see how this impacts the markets and what's next is going to be such an important thing.
It sure is, Patrick. And, you know, something I really find striking is it's so easy for so many of us to just feel like, wow, look at how dramatically the world has changed just in the last 2 or 3 months with this Russia-Ukraine thing coming completely out of nowhere. Nobody saw it coming. And then you say, wait a minute. Now, they did see it coming. Dr. Pippa Malmgren writing back in October saying World War III has already begun. Mike Green telling me a year ago World War III has already begun. And at the time, Mike didn't even want to talk about it publicly because he was afraid people would think he's crazy. Now he doesn't sound crazy to be talking about World War III, even though he actually saw those signals more than a year ago. So I really give him credit for that. At the time, I was very skeptical to believe him just because I overload those three words, World War III, with that specific meaning of nuclear holocaust. And that's really not what either Pippa or Mike were saying when they made that prediction. So I think it's going to be very interesting in coming weeks and months to get more and more of our expert guests' perspective on what this geopolitical cycle means to markets and to the world. In any event, Patrick, let's move on now to our post-game chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Sector rotation, Patrick. What do we got here on page two?
Well, I want to start with the S&P 500, and we'll just look at the dollar and crude oil as well. But, you know, when we look at that S&P 500 chart on page two, we're, you know, 7% off of the high from December. And overall, you know, everyone can look at this on the surface and say, well, the stock market's just been grinding in this period. But what we'll talk about a little bit later in the chart deck is just try to grasp what is actually happening under the surface amongst all the different sectors and how things have been evolving. So I want to get to that in a moment. One key thing for me, though, on this S&P is the lows that were put in just late last week and early this week, down just below 4,400, I think are going to be a really important reference point. Overall, if the stock market does have enough gas in the tank to go and retest its highs, even if the whole year is going to be defined as one big trade range, if we are first destined to go higher, we should see those lows hold. And what I'm going to be looking for is follow through above today's highs around the 45 and a quarter areas where I'm keeping a close eye on there. If we see that, then that might give us a short-term rally throughout April toward the top end of the range. I think that while there is room for the stock market to have inevitably some sort of a deeper correction, it may not happen in the second quarter of the year. It may actually be something that happens a little bit later in the year.
Now, please help me understand that, Patrick, because when I listen to a Charlie McElligott, I'm thinking, okay, the downside's not over. It ought to be happening in the next month or so, and we'd see the final bottom in May or so. Sounds like you're saying you feel pretty darn confident about the strength of the market in the next few weeks, but maybe there's a deeper dip coming later in the summer or later on. Why the delay? I'm not quite following you there.
Well, you know, the part here is that, look, almost all of the bad news has been thrown in the market. There is no, this bad news is not going to create the liquidity event shock that creates these massive market downdrafts. What we're having and what we'll talk about when we get to the sector rotation part is the fact that this is changing the way everyone is allocating money and what, where they're allocating it to. So they're being far more defensive in the way that they're positioning their portfolios. But listen, if this Ukraine situation and rising commodity price and all of these Fed rate hikes and everything like this being thrown at the market, if that has not caused the market to break on the downside immediately now, then what will? At least on the short term. And I think there needs to be a new catalyst introduced to the market to create that shock. And so I do think that overall thematically everyone is on the same page, which is that it's going to be very hard for the stock market to get uber bullish. It's like a wet blanket thrown on the top of the market that's going to keep it, you know, more or less contained. But I don't think it's all downside from here, at least not on the short term. And I still think that there's a room for at least some sort of retesting toward 46 to 4800. But we'll be watching whether those lows hold there.
Well, that makes sense, Patrick. And I would say, if you want to know what's the catalyst that brings around the next really big move down, it's the widespread public realization that Russia-Ukraine is not about Russia-Ukraine. It's just one little battle in a much larger war. That's a view that I think is very non-consensus still. And if that view became consensus, I think that would be the source of your downside catalyst. But you're right. I don't see anything that's changing right now to make that view mainstream. Let's move on to the dollar index, Patrick, on page 3. Boy, sure looks like a bullish chart if I've ever seen one.
Yeah, and what we continue to see is the pattern of dips being bought, what continues to be the case. And what's actually something that I don't have on the chart here is the big move that just happened on the U.S. dollar versus the renminbi. And with the Japanese yen moving, you're having a lot of these Asian currencies really starting. And the euro and the pound continue to be incredibly weak. The only currencies that actually seem to be reasonably dug in are things like the Aussie and Canadian dollars, and largely because probably of their commodity-driven economies. But overall, I think that the primary trend of the dollar remains intact. But I wanted to just move on, though, to crude oil, and you can sort of give me feedback on my observations. But overall, obviously, we had this huge pop on crude on the front months that saw that big reaction to the obvious boots on the ground between Russia and Ukraine that caused oil to spike. But really, since then, we've been more or less in a sideways consolidation, and about $30 swings higher and lower from the peak price to the low. And the question really is that how long does the market need to backfill and consolidate before the next trend move breaks out? And for me, I think it's really simple to now just anchor off of the $100 round number on this contract, because if we see that crude oil is consolidating here in this kind of 100 to 110 area, it may very well attempt to break out. And I'd be really curious whether or not in the most intermediate term here, whether oil can actually make another full bull leg higher. What levels are you watching on crude?
Well, definitely a sustained move above that spike peak to 130 would be a big move. But, you know, the way I look at this chart is it just perfectly says to me what we saw was a buildup to that, oh my gosh, moment when people were threatening nuclear war. We got the test to 130, and now we're seeing what looks like a very, very typical consolidation pattern where we kind of whipsaw up and down and find our way to a consolidation about halfway through that last really big push that occurred on the news of nuclear threats and so forth coming out of Ukraine and so forth. And, you know, clearly, if you think what's about to happen here is Putin and Biden suddenly make friends, decide to be best buddies and go play golf together, well, then oil's going down, straight down. And, you know, if you're going to live in that fantasy, you might as well make it playing golf at Mar-a-Lago with former President Trump caddying for them, because I think that's about as realistic as this conflict with Russia being over anytime soon. The way I'm seeing this is there's lots of room for more dips to happen lower as we get various little bits of news that don't really give us the whole picture and it looks like maybe things are getting better, of course there's going to be dips lower. Eventually, I think what you find is there's no clean resolution to this, and World War III really is happening, just like Pippa and Mike have warned us. And if that's the case, we go higher, not lower, in the long term from here.
Let's move on to page 5, where I have the New York Stock Exchange, a percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving averages. And I like to use this as a breadth indicator of just, you know, how many stocks are participating in terms of trending. And we're more or less pivoting back and forth around the 50% line. And I wanted to use this as our kind of conversation starter into what's going on in the underneath the hood and when looking at the different sectors within the market. We basically have a scenario where rather than the market crash occurring in the on the reaction to the Russian events, what we really have now seen is that portfolio managers are rather focusing on reallocating capital to more defensive sectors. And so I wanted to, on pages 7 through to 10 or 11, just talk about the sectors that are working. So what we're seeing is that the sector such as the consumer staples, which are clearly broken 52-week highs and just a ripping higher. You have the healthcare space that temporarily broke to a higher high and trading very close to those 52-week highs. You have the metals and mining ETF that has been broke to a fresh 52-week high back in February and has not looked back. You know, you have the energy ETF and those huge energy companies just continuing to plug higher, even as oil corrected, these energy stocks keep making 52-week highs. And, you know, you take the utilities and you take something that you would think would be impacted by rising interest rates as bond proxies and all the debt that they carry. But no, these utilities continue to be bought and pushing 52-week highs and running. These are areas that most conventional investors would normally not turn to. And so there's clearly some big money managers that are trying to reweigh their beta exposures and de-risk in a lot of the different sectors. So the question is, what is dragging down the market with when all of these sectors are doing so well? And what's not been working is all the high multiple areas such as the technology. I don't have the home builders index. I probably should have included it in there. But on page 14, you can see the social media ETF, which is down 60, 70% off of its highs. The financials continue to get dragged down. And of course, the unprofitable tech space, such as ARK Innovation, just continues to be decimated, about to make a fresh new 52-week low on the downside. And so there's this massive rotation. There's this huge bear market going on in a series of these sectors that are being very heavily sold. And the indices on the surface, like the S&P 500, are not actually showing it. So, you know, when we're really looking at what's happening here, then it comes back to that story, though. If this news, this confrontation in and geopolitical stuff that's going on with Russia, if that was going to cause the market to crash, then we should have seen the liquidity being drawn out of the market as everyone is selling relentlessly. But instead, it's just de-risking by choosing more defensive sectors.
Well, Patrick, I think this is a really valuable perspective to look at the sectors, because to my thinking, it's the best insight we have as to what money managers are thinking about this whole World War III cycle. How are they repositioning in order to get ready for it? And I think it's very telling. Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading. You can find information on page 17 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com. Diversify your portfolio with U.S. farmland, one of the most inflation-protected and recession-resilient asset classes in the world, now available to all accredited investors. And by Composer, making institutional-grade quantitative algorithmic trading and backtesting available to the masses. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a number of links to articles that we found interesting, so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.